You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
As a longtime foreign correspondent, I've worked in lots of places, but nowhere as important to the world as China. I'm Jane Perlez, former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. Join me on my new podcast, Face Off, U.S. versus China, where I'll take you behind the scenes in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. Find Face Off wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Susanna Fox, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast.
When I used to practice regular medicine, I was often presented by clinical conundrums that appeared to have no obvious answer. I was the doctor who everyone else sent their quote-unquote problem patients. Diagnostic curiosities, ill-defined symptoms, resilient syndromes that no medicine could solve, I encountered just about everything. Two techniques were invaluable in my treatment regimen. Besides doing all the basic tests to rule out all the usual badness, I promised that regardless of what we found together, we would still embark on a treatment regimen that may not solve every problem, but we would constantly seek improvement, diagnosis, or no diagnosis. My message was clear. I see you regardless of what your tests say, and we can work together to make things better. The second thing I always did was ask my patients what they thought was going on. I assured them that while I was the expert in medicine, they were the experts in themselves and their bodies. I encouraged their own research, read through their websites and support group chats, and I welcomed their innovations when I could ethically and legally support them. And sometimes their answers were better than mine. Today, we're going to talk about patient and peer empowerment when it comes to healthcare. While these sound like non-financial topics, the point of being good with money becomes less relevant if you aren't good with health. And healthcare costs, of course, bankrupt many. Susanna Fox is an American healthcare and information technology researcher who was the chief technology officer of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from May 2015 to January 2017. Prior to this, she spent 14 years at the Pew Research Center studying the impact of internet technology on healthcare. Her new book is Rebel Health, A Field Guide to the Patient-Led Revolution in Medical Care. Susanna Fox, welcome to Earn and Invest. I have to start at the beginning. Who the heck is Brett Adler, and why did he inject himself with his own semen?
Okay, good. Wow, we're jumping right in. I love it. Brett is someone who really went through hell, came out the other side, and is willing to share what happened. And that makes him part of the Rebel Alliance of Healthcare. He's part of the Church of Latter-day Saints, commonly known as the Mormon Church. And one of the tenets of that church is that you wait until marriage for all sexual activity. And that means that he did not have a lot of experience with ejaculation. He didn't know that he was actually someone who lives with a very rare allergy, and that is he is allergic to his own semen. And he found that out when he and his wife were on their honeymoon. He thought that he was coming down with the flu or had caught a bug. They were at a beautiful resort in Mexico. And because he is very scientifically minded, he started doing self-tracking, and he and his wife realized that he only experienced these flu-like symptoms after they had had sex. And he immediately wanted to solve this problem, and he did a lot of research online, but he couldn't find other people at first who were willing to talk to him using their real names, because a lot of people carry some shame around this. They don't want to talk about it. Well, Brett wants to talk about it because he was able to figure out a solution thanks to a published medical journal article. It was actually published based on a study in the Netherlands. with other men who have the same condition, and they were able to find treatment. And I'm happy to say that Brett and his wife have gone on to have 8 children.
And so he injected himself because basically we know that when people are allergic to certain things, they can inject themselves and slowly sensitize themselves. He couldn't find a doctor who would do it. So ultimately, he did something which we don't necessarily suggest, but he took that step of solving the problem himself by figuring out a protocol and injecting himself. And it worked, right?
Yeah, and it worked. And this is an example of do-it-yourself personal science, DIY personal science. And yes, I do talk about some extreme examples like Brett in the book, because they are attention-getting. But this is actually a much more common phenomenon. It's not always people with rare disease who are engaging in this kind of thing, but it is people with rare disease who are the pioneers, who are willing to try anything because they got dropped into a really dark corner of the healthcare maze, and they're pretty much willing to do anything to try and get out of it.
I want to talk about more of these stories. But first, I want to know how you ended up part of that healthcare maze. You started at the Pew Center studying the effect of the internet on healthcare. How did you end up there? I mean, it's a really fascinating thing. And especially, we're talking about 20 years ago. So this was before people really understood the role the internet played in healthcare.
Well, let me start even a little further back. I am the daughter of an engineer and a dance critic and business writer. My dad had been able to convince both my brother and sister to be engineers, and I came along as the third and studied anthropology. And my dad was kind of appalled. He didn't think that I would ever have a job, frankly. But I watched how he was an early internet user in the 80s, and I learned from him. And so when I had the opportunity to learn how to code and build websites, that's how I spent my 20s. I built websites. And then I switched gears. In the year 2000, I joined the Pew Research Center's Internet Project. And looking back, it was a turning point in my career and in my life. I was pregnant with my first child, and I did not want to have the startup life anymore, which is what I had spent my 20s doing. And so I became a researcher and actually was assigned 3 topics that first year. I was assigned to look at the internet's impact on banking, privacy and security, and healthcare. Healthcare is the one that really hit. My very first study got cited in JAMA, which I had no idea what a big deal that was.
Yeah, the Journal of the American Medical Association, which is one of the predominant medical journals.
And I remain really fascinated by how technology is changing banking, but I fell in love with how it was empowering consumers. People were able to flip the power hierarchy and get access to information and data that they didn't have access to before.
It's an important point, right? Because we talk about rebel healthcare. You talk about this in your book, but traditionally, our healthcare system really is pushed for compliance. Were you surprised when you started doing this internet research? Were you surprised that there were these voices speaking out and pushing against what had just pretty much been accepted for a recordable time, especially in the United States?
I was surprised because that was not part of my personal experience up until then. My family had always had kind of run-of-the-mill things wrong with it. There were people who got sick, but they got better. And there weren't a lot of mysteries in my family history. And so it was through fieldwork in online patient communities where I met people who had to go out to the edges, go out and build a new civilization as pioneers at the edges of genetic testing and trading tips about how to survive on the frontier of healthcare.
So you started back around 2000. This was a very quiet revolution, wasn't it? I mean, I feel like back then, and maybe even today, but certainly back then, it was really happening on the periphery.
It's always happened on the margins. And by the way, it was not just the internet that started this revolution. One way that I try to bring that forward is by talking in the book about the origins of peer-to-peer healthcare with Alcoholics Anonymous in the 1930s, you know, La Leche League in the 1950s, and the disability rights movement that came forward. All of these radical health movements built the foundation of what I came to call peer-to-peer healthcare. And the internet has allowed it to speed up. It's broken down all the barriers of time and space so that anybody can connect. No one is alone. And what I love is a lot of the activity that I started tracking in the year 2001, 2002, a lot of it was happening on email listservs and bulletin board systems. It's the same instinct that people had in the 1940s and that people had in the 2000s, that people have today to connect with one another. They want to find that just in time, someone like them who's going to have the advice that they need at that moment. And now we just have the ability to do it in fancier ways, but it's the same instinct.
Susanna, how did you learn the science? Because you're a technology person. And as we get into this book, I mean, we get to these complicated principles like biohacking your diabetic machines and building an artificial pancreas. Did you have trouble learning the science from the technology perspective?
Well, this is where my anthropology training actually came in really handy. Anthropology, the way I think of it, is that it's training that allows you to be professionally curious. And I entered into these communities, whether they were communities of people living with rare disorders, with cancer, with life-changing diagnoses like HIV, ALS, and I just wanted to learn from them. And in order to understand what they were talking about, I needed to read the medical journal articles. And I very happily had a mentor, Tom Ferguson. He was a Yale-trained MD who took me under his wing. And while he was my mentor, he was somebody, it was like a one-on-one PhD program where he would explain the science to me. And I'm very grateful to Tom.
So the name of the book is Rebel Healthcare. You know, the idea of rebellion suggests that there's some who our system is serving and some who it isn't. Who do you think our modern day healthcare system is serving and who's being left behind?
When you think about whose needs are being met in the current healthcare system, you think about people who have a diagnosis and there is not only one treatment, but multiple treatments to choose from. I also added this idea of visibility because there might be someone whose needs are being met, but they still feel invisible. They feel like their questions are not yet being answered by mainstream healthcare. They've gotten their needs met, but it's only through peer-to-peer small group intervention. So you think about things like a healthy pregnancy. That's an obvious one, or a broken arm, something that is acute that can be fixed. Where you start to get into some more interesting areas is if you think about diabetes. Now, diabetes looks to an outsider like a solved problem. And they've been given insulin. They've been given other medications. There are even some amazing technologies like continuous glucose monitors and insulin pumps. But one of the problems is that there's uneven access to all of those treatments and those devices. And there's uneven access to the data that is generated by those devices. And that's when you see diabetes starting to slip down into the less visible and needs not met part of the healthcare system.
In fact, you call this the rebel health matrix. You say it's a way to understand the full picture of suffering and the potential for improvement in the healthcare system. Describe for us what the rebel health matrix is. It's something you come back to over and over again in the book, and it's incredibly instructive. Obviously, people listening here can't see your diagrams, but kind of describe to us what that looks like.
Sure. So imagine aligned the x-axis and on the left are issues that where the needs are not being met. And on the right are issues where needs are being met. And down the middle, the y-axis, at the top are issues where they are fully visible to the mainstream system. And at the bottom of that axis, the vertical axis, is where people are invisible. And they're just not seen by the mainstream healthcare system. The lower left quadrant, where needs are not met and people are invisible, is the quadrant of suffering. That is where people living with rare or undiagnosed conditions, that's where people, unfortunately, are living if they have questions that they don't get answers to their satisfaction. A really important part of the Rebel Health Matrix is that it's up to people themselves to define if their needs are being met. And that's really important to me, because there's so many times, like, for example, vaccine hesitancy. That's an issue where the mainstream system says, take this vaccine. If somebody has a question and they don't get answers that satisfy them, then their needs aren't being met.
You know, it's amazing. And I think part of my intro, really, I lived as a doctor very much in that left lower quadrant with people who had often undiagnosable diseases. And so they felt invisible. And then, of course, no one believed them because they couldn't figure out what was going on with them. And then, of course, their needs weren't being met. The magic of that as a clinician is all I had to do was say, I believe you're having these symptoms and I'm going to try to help. And automatically I could push them into a different quadrant, even if I couldn't figure out what they had, even if I didn't know what the right medicines were. But I actually found that incredibly empowering as a clinician, which I think is not the way a lot of people look at these kind of issues.
It's incredible how important it is to say, I see you, to someone. As a clinician, you have that power to say, I see you, and to make someone feel valued, and to make someone feel like they can share the truth of their experience and have you understand it in some fashion. Very often, people don't have that privilege, and they need to turn to other patients, other caregivers, other survivors who they can gather together and say, we see you.
And I believe you are one of the people who coined the phrase peer-to-peer healthcare. Tell us exactly what that is, because I think it's such a big part of this book and what we're talking about.
Peer-to-peer healthcare is the idea that the internet gives us access not only to information, but also to each other. And it's a deceptively simple insight that I think is the megatrend poised to change healthcare for the better. Because by telling each other stories, we can see ourselves more clearly and see each other more clearly and begin to network and pool resources and solve problems.
And it's interesting because the access and the telling the stories is the beginning, but you've actually defined four archetypes of people involved in this Rebel Healthcare. Talk about those four archetypes and how they fit into the internet age.
Thank you. The first archetype that I talk about are seekers. When someone gets knocked down, when some setback happens, there are a lot of people who are too stunned or exhausted to take any action. But then there's some spark, whether it's anger or frustration or hope, that makes them go out on the hunt for information. Seekers go out looking for answers and they do not give up. That characterizes seekers. The second group are networkers. Networkers are the type of people who cannot help but learn in community. They gather people around them, online or offline. Often when I'm talking about peer-to-peer healthcare, people say, oh, I know what you're talking about. You're talking about AA, or you're talking about Weight Watchers, or you're talking about Facebook groups. And I say, yes, and it's so much deeper than that. They are the people who will pool resources, find great stuff, and share it with the community. The third group are solvers. Solvers are the type of people who, if something isn't working, they will take it apart and put it back together again better, whether that's an assistive device
or a medical device or a system. There are solvers who will look at, for example, a clinical trial that they or a loved one is enrolled in, and they'll have ideas for how to improve that clinical trial. And clinicians and scientists will be very well served by listening to the solvers in their patient population. The fourth group are champions. Champions have access to the resources controlled by mainstream healthcare, and they share those resources with a patient-led group. That could be funding. That could be regulatory guidance. It could be access to specialized labs or manufacturing facilities or materials. A journalist can be a champion by shining a spotlight on a patient-led group.
We are talking to Susanna Fox. She is the American Healthcare and Information Technology Researcher who is the Chief Technology Officer of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services from May 2015 to January 2017. Prior to this, she spent 14 years at the Pew Research Center. And we are talking about the peer-to-peer healthcare movement. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we're going to discuss seekers, networkers, solvers, and champions. Those are the four archetypes of rebels in our rebel healthcare system. But first, a break. I'm Doc G, and this is the Earn and Invest podcast. All right, so most of us know the bad news already. If you were using Mint as a budgeting app, it has shut down. But the good news is there's something better, and it's called Monarch Money. I started using Monarch Money myself about 5 months ago, and I knew immediately that I liked it more than any other budgeting app I had ever used. For one, it focuses on collaboration. This is easy to share with your spouse, your partner, your financial advisor, and it's aspirational. Not only can you look at your current budget, but what do you want to buy? What do you want your goals to be? You can focus on those in Monarch Money. It's the next generation of personal finance apps. Monarch is the top-rated all-in-one personal finance app. It gives you a comprehensive view of all your accounts, investments, transactions, and more. Furthermore, you can create custom budgets, track progress toward financial goals, and collaborate with your partner. And now get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/earn. Again, that's monarchmoney.com/EARN. What I like about this app is it's intuitive, easy to use, quick to sign on. It's collaborative, as we talked about. It's customizable. The idea is you can use this app the way you want to use it. And the reason why is the Monarch Money team is customer focused. They are focusing on you, me, and all the other people who want to use this app to live a better financial life. After trying out Monarch Money for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, listeners of this show will get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/earn. That's monarchmoney.com/EARN for your extended 30-day free trial. You know what? I love our meals from Factor. My son started getting them about a year ago when he needed a quick alternative to meals on the go. But where we've really enjoyed them is we've been remodeling our kitchen. That's right, we've had no access to our kitchen for the last few weeks. And some nights, we just had no idea what to do for a meal. That is where Factor came in. We would just pop the meal in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, we'd have a fantastic meal. You can do the exact same thing, and there's tons of variety. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week. These are chef-prepared meals, and let me tell you, they are delicious. No fuss, no mess. You just put it in the microwave, and 2 minutes later, you have a meal. This is tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with the flexibility to get as much or as little as you need. Head to factormeals.com/earn50 and use your code EARN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code EARN50 at factormeals.com/earn50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. We are back with Susanna Fox. Her book is Rebel Health, A Field Guide to the Patient-Led Revolution in Medical Care. And we are talking about the four archetypes of rebels in our healthcare system. That is seekers, networkers, solvers, and champions. Susanna, let's start with a seeker. Tell us about Nell Minow and Mobius syndrome, because that's something a lot of us have never heard of.
Nell Minow is someone who shared this story with me because we were talking about the bravery of patients and caregivers. And she told about how her uncle Bert was born in the early 20th century, and he was the first child of his parents, and he was born with full facial paralysis, and they did not know what this meant. And at that time, his parents were told to put him in an institution and forget about him and go on and build their family. And they said, no, we're bringing him home. And they raised him alongside their other children. He had no intellectual disability. It was just facial paralysis that he was challenged by. And in fact, he was very witty. He was super smart. He went to all through mainstream education and college and became part of the family laundry business in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. But they never had a diagnosis until he was pretty late in life. I think he was in his 60s when he finally got a diagnosis of Mobius syndrome. Nell was an early internet user, and she would test search engines with obscure terms just to see what she came up with. And one day in the 90s, Nell tested a new search engine by typing in Mobius syndrome. And she found a new website that had been organized by Mobius syndrome parents. And she wrote to them and said, oh, my uncle has Mobius syndrome. Now, at this time, the medical literature only had evidence of people living into their 30s. And so this group of parents was very excited when they found out that Bert Minow was in his 70s. And they sent out the word across the world to other parents that these children would live a typical lifespan. And Bert Minow got to be the elder statesman of this worldwide community where he had finally found his people.
Bert became almost a hero.
He absolutely became a hero.
Now, we're talking about this in a sense only because of the birth of the internet. Could this have all happened without this thing that allowed us to connect with people far and wide? I mean, do you think that this rebel healthcare movement, this evolution of seekers who are out there and connecting with other people, could any of that happen without the internet?
There have always been seekers. They had to use the library. They had to type letters to each other. They had to find other ways to connect. It was much more difficult because information was kept locked up and out of reach of patients and caregivers. And it was very, very difficult to find other people like them. But the Mobius Syndrome Foundation was founded by two moms who connected in 1991 because one of them had written to a rare disease group and found out that they only lived a few miles from each other in the suburbs of LA, and they otherwise never would have found each other. They never would have known that they both had kids with Mobius syndrome, and they were the ones who built the website that Nell Minow stumbled upon.
We're going to talk about networkers in a minute, but what does the traditional healthcare system think of seekers and networkers?
I think that people understand that seekers are in our midst, but I don't think that clinicians and policymakers and other healthcare leaders understand how powerful seekers are and how really, if you think about it, we want everyone to either be a seeker or recruit a seeker to their team if they need them, because seekers are people who are going to find out the answers. If they don't understand a treatment that they're being offered, if they're worried about side effects, if they're not sure about something, seekers are the ones who are not going to give up until they get those answers. And that's actually what we need. We need engagement.
What separates a seeker from a networker?
A seeker is somebody who may or may not want to join a group. this as a, I have to confess, I am a natural extrovert. I am a networker. And so it was very interesting in my research to meet people who were seekers, who would go and find great stuff, but they kept it to themselves. Once they had solved their problem and gotten their answer, they didn't have a need to share it with a group. So a networker is somebody who finds things and shares them. They love to create community.
Let's talk about that sharing, because you say in your book, networkers crowdsource the truth. And it begs the question then, how accurate is peer-to-peer sharing? Because I think medical institutions are very comfortable with the idea that they have peer-reviewed scientific data that is rigorous enough that the risk of having harmful or damaging material put out there is less. What we're talking about here is homemade scientists, people who are learning from each other, they're learning from themselves, they're putting the information out there. Is this kind of sharing accurate? Could it be dangerous?
It could be dangerous. We saw this during the COVID-19 shutdown when we were all learning across the world about this new virus. And one of the challenges of science, as you know, is that it's not always settled. It is something that evolves. And COVID-19 is an area of science that patients themselves are contributing to our understanding as much as clinicians and scientists are contributing to it. When we are all learning together, that's when we need to hold things very lightly. We need to understand that science does evolve. That's a really difficult concept for a lot of people. They want there to be a black and white answer to things. And for some areas, yeah, there is a black and white answer. But for other things, we need to be attuned to breaking news and a building of evidence. The key with peer-to-peer healthcare is, number one, patients and caregivers and survivors know things about their own bodies and their own experiences that science could benefit from. And tapping into the knowledge that is pooled by peer-to-peer healthcare is an opportunity. Number two, we need to give people access to all the best science. Gone is the time when medical journal articles should be locked up and kept out of reach. We should empower networkers to be able to fact check and share the good stuff. There are some wonderful studies that I cite in the book about healthy online communities that show out of thousands of messages, there were just a handful that contained misinformation, that contained incorrect information. And a healthy online community almost acts like that's a virus, that they're going to swarm. Its antibodies are strong against that. And that information is taken down within hours. That's really what we need to build. Misinformation is a threat to our whole society, and we need a whole of society response to it. We can't leave the patients out of this conversation.
Yeah, and I think if you're uncomfortable with this idea of self-correcting within peer-to-peer groups when it comes to healthcare and medicine, all you have to do is look at something like Wikipedia, which is self-correcting. And while not 100% accurate, it actually generally is accurate enough that people use it in their research papers, et cetera. So we're kind of doing this outside of healthcare already. We've mentioned the four archetypes: seekers, networkers. Let's move on to solvers. And I think we get a little more controversial here. No, not controversial in the sense that if I have a family member with Parkinson's and I develop an assistive device that physically helps them and it's obvious it helps them and no one's done that before, that's pretty straightforward. But when we get to the Brett Adlers, right? Brett basically injected himself with biologic material, even though healthcare workers told him not to. In this case, he was right and solved his problems. Another person you talk about in your book is Umberto Macedo, who is not a scientist, not a doctor, but he conducted a scientific study that had an impact. How did that come about?
I love this story because it's another example of people who are living with something that is a death sentence. In this case, it's ALS. And there was a glimmer of hope. There was a glimmer of hope out of Italy that there was a chance that lithium, could slow down the progress of ALS. And so Umberto, who was a young man living in Brazil, decided to try it. And he was using the website Patients Like Me, which was founded by the Haywood brothers, in order to try and create what they think of as a time machine for people with ALS and now with many other conditions and disorders, to try and pool as many people as possible with a single disease so that you can start to see where you might be heading in terms of your progress. That's the idea of uploading your data to Patients Like Me. And so the scientists who work at Patients Like Me said, okay, let's do this right. Let's try and create essentially a clinical trial where people know, you know, which study group they're in. Let's pair people up with ALS who have a similar symptom trajectory. And one person is going to take lithium and the other person is not. And we're going to very, very carefully track the data. They got this up and running very quickly, and they were able to return results faster than any clinical trial could have. Unfortunately, it showed that lithium did not stop the progress of ALS. And so it was a disappointing result, but at least the patients were able to contribute to the science and contribute to the discovery. Unfortunately, that the treatment didn't work, but that sense of we could do this together is intoxicating.
It's interesting. Lithium is a known substance. It's been studied. So this idea that people could use lithium, something we know about already, and do this what feels like an unorthodox scientific study fits, right? The other side is there are medicines out there that could have side effects or things we don't understand as well. But what's amazing in that story really is the agility. Like, our healthcare system does not move that agilely. And in this case, they were able to do a really profound piece of work, quickly get an answer and move on. And we just don't see that in the practice of science in our American healthcare system as much.
We don't. There are, again, some glimmers of hope. David Fagenbaum at Penn is working on repurposing drugs. He was able to repurpose a drug to save his own life. And he is now working on these big data experiments, looking at all of the drugs that are sitting on shelves and how might they actually be redeployed for rare diseases. So that, to me, is a glimmer of light. And that is based at a mainstream scientific university.
Up until this point, we've been talking about the archetypes. And when I think of seekers, networkers, and solvers, I really think about this idea of insiders. These are either the people who have the disease themselves or have a family member who has the disease, et cetera. The last archetype of these healthcare rebels are champions. And I feel like this is the one group where we have the potential for outsiders, people who are not dealing with this disease themselves and yet can further the conversation. Who are the champions of the world and what do they do?
Champions are people who recognize that the patient-led revolution is going to be aligned with their own mission. Their mission might be a scientific one. It might be a business mission. It might be a policymaking mission. And champions look across the landscape, recognize when there are patients and caregivers who are creating something new, who could benefit from the resources that they, the champion, have access to. And they make sure that they get those resources to the teams who need them.
So when we look at this as a whole, we've been talking about this rebel healthcare movement. What we're really talking about is peer-to-peer health. In closing, what do you think the biggest obstacle today is to the peer-to-peer health movement?
I think the biggest obstacle to peer-to-peer health is the sense that consumers should stay quiet and do what doctors tell them to do. And when I wrote about people who are the pioneers and the rebels, I was struck by how often they were motivated because they had few other choices. It took courage for people to raise their hand and ask for help. It took courage for them to go against what is the mainstream healthcare system. And what I would love for people to understand is that there is a growing body of evidence. There's a growing movement within science and within medicine to embrace peer-to-peer healthcare. And so I would love to see more people understand that this is moving toward the mainstream in some areas. And the next time you get knocked down by a health condition, to think about how you can raise your hand. No one is alone. There are people out there who would love to help you if only they knew how to find you.
You're optimistic that healthcare policymakers are listening and maybe ready for change?
I am, because this is a mega trend. It's 1 in 4 American adults has gone online to look for someone like them. It's even more common among young people, 14 to 22 year olds. And it's something that is an unstoppable force. It's very human to want to connect with other people. And now, thanks to technology, people are able to connect and share resources. And it's our opportunity to help them and build a more inclusive and responsive healthcare system.
Well, Susanna, I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today. I really wanted to highlight this book because the truth of the matter is almost all major revolutions happen with storytelling, with sharing, with networking. And when we do that, the true solvers come out and the champions help them make durable change. And I think anyone involved in healthcare today, certainly if you've been on the patient side, realizes that it doesn't necessarily feel accommodating to people who have anything outside of the typical or quote-unquote normal problem. And I think your book goes a far way to helping us expand our ideas of what healthcare can look like in America today and realize that it is a shared venture, that it is not just the doctors, it's not just the policymakers, it's all of us working together to make things better. I want to end this episode the way I end every episode by asking you what is coming up next. First and foremost, this book is available now, correct?
It sure is, everywhere where books are sold.
And if people are interested in learning more, what is the best way for them to connect with you?
I'm on all the major social media platforms. LinkedIn is probably where I'm spending the most time. And I have a website, SusannaFox.com.
The book is Rebel Health, A Field Guide to the Patient-Led Revolution in Medical Care. Susanna Fox, thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thanks for having me.
That's a wrap.
Earn and Invest is now part of the Airwave Media Podcast Network. Visit airwavemedia.com to listen and subscribe to this show as well as other fine podcasts.
It was really fun having Susanna Fox on the podcast. Interestingly enough, she is actually from my former world as a medical blogger when I was part of the medical blogosphere and medical social media. Back in the early 2000s, I interacted with a lot of people like Susanna, and she was one of those people changing healthcare. And I was trying to do the same, write about being a doctor, write about what it felt like to be a doctor and how that affected the doctor-patient relationship. It really is a blast from the past. You might be wondering why I wanted to have her on Earn and Invest. And there are a few big reasons. One, first and foremost, is there's no way to talk about our healthcare system and not think about the expense. So if you're interested in financial independence or interested in personal finance at all, you have to think about how your medical care is going to cost you. How do you save and budget for it? Our medical care affects just about everything, and it certainly affects our bank accounts and our budgets and our ability to invest. So this was something I felt really important to talk about on the podcast. But the other reason I wanted to have her on is to talk about the framework for change. Now, she's talking about peer-to-peer healthcare, But let's talk about this framework and this idea that they're the archetypes, these archetypes that affect almost anything we do, whether this is changing our healthcare or building a business or changing our personal habits when it comes to money. The archetypes are the seekers, the networkers, the solvers, and the champions. Again, the seekers, networkers, solvers, and champions. And I think it's a great framework for almost anything we do. So if you're thinking about building a business and you're looking for people to help you, you might be a seeker. You might be seeing something in the world that needs to be changed. You may get together with networkers, other people who can find those who are in the same situation as you who want to work on change, maybe want to build a business about change. Then they're the solvers. These are your tech people, the people who are going to help you actually fix the problem. And last but not least, they're the champions out there, the people who have resources, whether that's venture capital, private equity, or just someone in the community who trumpets what you're doing and helps connect other people to what you're creating. So we were talking about peer-to-peer healthcare, and we're talking about how healthcare is changing and being driven by patients and their family members. But I think we have a similar revolution going on with technology and business building right now. It used to be, if you wanted to start a business, you had to go to business school, you had to learn technically how that's done. And then you'd go out there and join the leagues of other MBA graduates and you'd start your business. But that's not how things are done anymore. People are relying on themselves. They're relying on the internet. They're relying less on education and professors and relying more on their own ability to self-teach and to work with others who are doing similar important things. And so I think this was a huge message of what Susanna was talking about today and how it relates not just to healthcare, but also to our bottom line when it comes to our finances. And especially if you are an entrepreneur and you're into business building, these are the archetypes of the people who might help you create what you want to see in the world. Last but not least, I wanted to remind everyone that the Path to Purpose financial coaching program is well on its way. I've been doing it for about 6 weeks now. These are mostly five-pack sessions. In fact, I've been graduating the first group of people to go through this coaching process. It's been really fun. I think people have been coming out of the program feeling a much renewed sense of purpose and what they want to do with their life. And I'd love you to be part of the program. Go to earnandinvest.com/coaching. Again, that's earnandinvest.com/coaching. If you are looking for coaching regarding issues such as enough, purpose, career changes, these are the kind of things we talk about. And this is the sweet spot of what I talk about in my book, in this podcast, and in this coaching. I'd love to let you know more about it. Go to earnandinvest.com/coaching. Again, that's earnandinvest.com/coaching. All right, I leave things running just for a few minutes to catch whatever we say as the after show. Anything about the book I left out? As I always tell people, like, a book like yours is so full of great stuff, great stories, etc. In a 30-40 minute interview, I can only talk about so much, so I try to condense and cover the broad strokes. Anything like we didn't cover or you really wish we talked about?
I would say that if someone is curious to see the full stack of the Rebel Health Alliance, it is present in type 1 diabetes. That's an area where so much of living with diabetes involves behavior change, and it involves a daily tracking of both the intake of food and of insulin. That's an area where seekers, networkers, solvers, and champions have worked together to create a much better life for people living with insulin-requiring diabetes than we saw even just 10 years ago.
And the things that have happened with diabetes care have leapt forward, especially because a number of these patient movements. So I believe, right, it was a patient who pretty much started the first artificial pancreas, right? So they were able to biohack their implantable insulin delivery device, get the data out of it, and then use it to start collecting data on how to better mimic the body's use of insulin normally, and then start reprogramming it in such a way that it could actually control blood sugars better, which is an incredibly complex procedure and was not really being done in the academic institutions nearly as fast and agilely as these, you know, population researchers, whatever we want to call them, these you know, citizen
experts
researchers.
Of lived experience. Yeah. Yeah. So I think their hashtag is "We are not waiting." And I would urge other people who are frustrated with the progress that's being made for their disease or their health condition is to think about, what are you not going to wait for? What are you going to ask for? Rebels break in and take what they need, and they start good trouble, in the words of John Lewis. And that's the spirit that I think could infuse the rest of healthcare. The other part of the Diabetes Rebel Alliance that I want to highlight is their focus on data access. The data that's generated by their own bodies, patients themselves should have access to that data. Think of all the other medical devices that generate data, and we don't have access to it.
Yeah,
that's a new front.
And people don't, I think if you're a layperson who doesn't deal with these things regularly, you have no idea how much data is out there on each person that you don't have access to. And I think the blood sugar monitoring that was in these machines was kind of the beginning. But it's pretty incredible the fact that there were third parties that felt paternalistically like it was somehow dangerous for you to have your own information. And what we're seeing is a lot of that kind of progress partially is being made by people who are accessing their own data and using it. And we know this. I mean, self-tracking is a thing, right? We know about people tracking their steps and their heart rate and their sleep. And it's become a lot more accepted over the last 20 years as technology has improved. It is a short jump to realize the same holds true for the bio data that could be available to people that kind of has been held behind curtains and kept away from the people who it actually belongs to.
Exactly right. And are trying to solve their own health mysteries. And we can't always get an appointment with a doctor when we need it to solve a mystery. And so why shouldn't we have access to the information, data, and tools that we need to solve our own problems?
Want to learn how you can make smarter decisions with your money? Well, I've got the podcast for you. I'm Sean Piles, and I host NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast. Our show features our team of nerds, personal finance experts in credit cards, banking, investing, and more. And they'll help you make the most of your money while cutting through the clutter and misinformation in today's world of personal finance. You'll get clarity on strategies to help you build your wealth, invest wisely, shop for financial products, and plan for major life events. Listen to NerdWallet's Smart Money Podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
It feels really good to be productive, but a lot of the time it's easier said than done, especially when you need to make time to learn about productivity so you can actually, you know, be productive. But you can start your morning off right and be ready to get stuff done in just a few minutes with the Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day podcast. New episodes drop every weekday, so listen and subscribe to Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts. That's Inc. Productivity Tip of the Day wherever you get your podcasts.